Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and the man we have here is such a familiar face that I think magically it will transport itself over the air, over the internet, and you'll know who I'm talking about when I say we have William Fichtner here today. Because he is a guy, if you've been watching movies or TV shows the last 25 years,
you've seen William Fichtner.
But right now, in addition to writing, directing, and starring in his first feature film as a multi-hyphenate, he's a regular on Mom. So that means he's in your homes every week, as he has been on other series before. But this is a smash hit, and it gives you an opportunity to show people that you can do comedy.
God, I hope so.
Well, what strikes me is, first off, you're really good in the show.
Thank you.
And it's a good show. But it is like theater on television, isn't it?
It's, well, the first time that I ever had a multi-cam sitcom experience was 29 years ago on a show called Grace Under Fire.
Mm-hmm. I love that show.
Yeah, the first season of that, I remember I was living in New York. I auditioned for it. I remember when I got the audition because I read it and I had an argument with my agent because I thought, who in the world would ever hire me for something like this? Ended up getting it and did the last 7 episodes of that first season. And then that was it. And that was a Chuck Lorre show. And then Chuck called me 20 some years later about this role on Mom, Adam. And it was a guest spot. It was a little guest spot arc. And he said, you know, if you like it, give me 3 or 4 episodes because I have this idea for it. And I did the 3 or 4 episodes, and that was season 3. And then a couple of months later, they called and they're like, we're not done with this. And I'm like, well, what are you thinking about? And then this is my 4th full-time season after that. So I've been having a grand time.
Well, I bet you have. It's because, as I say, now you're a theater-trained guy. And you've done mostly movies or filmed TV shows. Mm-hmm. So there's no audience. It must be really gratifying to have people laughing, you know, just like a real audience.
Well, it's somewhere between like a play and a film, like you just said. And what's really interesting about, you know, when you're shooting a film, even if it's a comedy, if something's funny, nobody can laugh.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You screw the soundtrack up.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times, even a couple of times on Cole Brooks, somebody, you know, busted out laughing. I'm like, really? Really? but on this, you know, you can't shoot everything on a Friday night because there's too much to do. So they shoot usually 7, 8 scenes on a Thursday without an audience. And then they save their favorite scenes sometimes, sure, or the ones that they can do on a Friday night in front of the live audience. But on Thursdays, if anybody thinks something funny, the crew, you know, the caterer, laugh out loud. Anybody can laugh. The guy in the boom up in the rafters, if he thinks it's funny, you laugh. And I love that about it. Because, and also, I love Friday nights. You know, multi-cam sitcoms, it's the writer's world, completely. But come Friday nights, that evening belongs to the audience. Because if the audience is loving it and a moment's happening, go take that moment. Because they'll ride with you and nobody's, you know, leaning in there to go, you know, tighten up that pause. Because if the audience is there, you know, pause away. Mm-hmm. As long as it's full.
Right.
We've interviewed Chuck Lorre, who is the king of television, And he and his cohorts apparently strive for perfection. And I've read stories, too, about he and his writing team will be off in a corner huddling while you're shooting.
Oh, yeah.
And coming up with alternate lines and alternate ideas. Does that throw you at all?
No, it's my favorite part of it. Mm-hmm. Friday nights, you have the audience. They come out and they go, we're going to try something new. Because to me, even no matter what medium I'm working in, to me, that immediacy of something is either give me 3 weeks to work on something or give me 5 minutes. Mm. Anything in between doesn't feel like it's quite enough. Or I love when they come up and go, we're going to try a whole new, you know, one time they came up and go, we had a whole new speech. I'm like, come on. they're like, do you want cue cards? And I'm like, no, I can't do that. But they do. And, you know, you come in on a Monday, you read the script, mm-hmm. which you usually don't get until the Friday before. And then you read that. And then the next day, by the end of that day, you'll get some rewrites. They'll hear the reading, you know, just the open table read, and they'll make changes.
Now,
then Tuesday.
Now, who's at that first table read?
Everybody. The network, the studio, the entire writing staff, all the producers. All the cast, stage manager, production coordinator, probably about 50 people.
Wow.
Are there to listen
50
to.
50 people, my gosh. And is there laughter? If they're at that read, do you get laughs? Yeah.
If you don't, something's really wrong.
Is it not scary? Is that not intimidating?
I'm not one to ever really get nervous. Sometimes you're hoping that you can make something work. And if it doesn't quite work on that first table read, it might not be there on Tuesday.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they'll look at things and you think, you know, in the beginning when I started working on the show, you know, if something changed, I thought, oh, I didn't make it work. But that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
They oftentimes, what you get on Tuesday is better than Monday. And what you get on Wednesday is better than Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
They fine tune it. They hone it. And by the time you're ready to shoot the script, it's tight. And if they have an alternative idea, they'll throw it at you on Friday night or on Thursday, which is great.
Wow.
It's alive.
Yeah.
It's very much alive.
Oh, it's totally alive.
So have you always been good at memorizing lines?
My feeling is this. If you know what you're saying, if you figure out what it is, what a moment's about in that, odds are 90% of the lines are already memorized.
Hmm.
You have that. And I'm also a little bit old school where I don't, you know, improv is a separate thing, and there were moments for that making Cold Brook when there was a moment of like, all right, do your thing. I want to hear what you're thinking of. Give me your impulse. But I'm also old school, you know, out of New York, which is, you know, when a playwright writes a line, he wrote it that way. It's the actor's responsibility to find out what was the moment that he was, you know, that he created when he wrote it. And can you find that moment in the rhythm? So, it's not crazy. But there's always one line every Friday night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that just doesn't.
Then I'm just, you know, wondering, is the audience really seeing me think right now on what that line is on the next page?
So take us back to the beginning. How did you start?
Long story short, I was a junior. I went to 2 years of college at Farmingdale on Long Island, the State University of New York at Farmingdale. And then I transferred, because it was two-year school at the time, to SUNY Brockport outside of Rochester, criminal justice major. And slight change of course.
I was going to say, yeah.
Just like people ask me all the time, does that help out playing cops? And I'm like, no. we partied. It's a whole other thing. But I was a junior, my first week of my junior year, and I got a call from an admissions counselor, and they said, listen, you're missing a fine arts course. You have to take one for your core. And I was like, oh, what's that? And they were like, well, you could take intro to theater or intro to music or something. And I'm like, well, the time didn't work, and I wasn't a big fan of 450 kids in a lecture room. That's a recipe to go to bed.
Yeah.
And so there was one class that fit the time slot, and it was an improv class. So I'm like, what's improv? And he explained it to me, and I said, sure, I'll take the improv class. And I still remember that teacher. Her name was Sally Rubin. She was a bit of a hippie. We're talking fall of 1976. And I never did anything like that. I mean, I really never saw any play in high school because we would sneak right out the back door and go play hockey. So growing up in Buffalo. This improv class was just so unbelievably eye-opening that there was this, you know, the experience in this sort of freedom with something that I'd never done before. And I saw a few plays when I was my first 2 years of college. You know, somebody took me into the city once. I saw a Broadway show and I was like blown away. I couldn't believe that that actually happens live every night. Mm. It was a musical at the Music Box Theater. So, I, you know, I'd been open to it a little bit, but now this is different because this is something where, you know, participatory sort of thing. So I love this class. Now, I'm not sure if the other theater members in there, theater, you know, majors, you know, it's a little clicky. I don't think they were really into me, but... One day, the teacher, Sally, she asked me, she said, can you stay after class today? And I thought, oh, I wonder if I did something. And all the students left. She shut the door. She came over. She goes, listen, I don't think I've ever said this before, but I think you should do this.
Wow.
And I'm like, I mean, that's like saying to me, you know, go home and build a spaceship.
It's, right. Mm-hmm.
And she explained why. She goes, you really, you know a moment and you listen. And I don't know what else to tell you. I think you should take other classes. And I was like, well, that was really sweet, but wow. So I did take a couple of other theater classes, is like just electives. And then I graduated college, and my girlfriend at the time bought me a book called How to Be a Working Actor by Katinka Mason. I mm-hmm. still remember it. I still have it. It's a little paperback, and it's the 101 of if you move to New York or L.A., what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go to school? And I read that book 10 times that summer of 78. And then I called up and I went and auditioned for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and I got in. And
just like Spencer Tracy.
A few years before me.
Yes.
But anyway, that's the long version. Sorry for being so long-winded. But that's how... it really all began. And then I went to New York and I waited tables for years.
That's in chapter one of How to Be a
yes.
Working Actor.
That's in chapter one. Yes, yeah. It is. Bartend,
right
wait tables.
After where you get your head shot.
That's
taken.
It. Yeah. You ever go to the Stardust Diner in New York City?
Where is that?
That's where they sing. Your waiters sing. And the problem is, you're like, just give me the fucking sandwich and finish your song. You know, they'll be right in the middle and you're starving or you're thirsty and they're up on the tables doing a whole number. I'm like, I'm thrilled for you. I really am. But if I could get some water, I would just love that. Thank you so much.
I went to a place in L.A. once and I don't remember where it was. Something tells me it was over like on La Cienega or something.
Ed DeBevick's.
Yes.
Ed DeBevick's.
Yes.
I had so many birthdays there and we still talk about it because we miss it.
Cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
They would do the YMs for everyone who doesn't know what Ed DeBevick's is.
It's still in Chicago.
It's still in Chicago, yep. But like they would dress 50s diner style, but they would do the YMCA and get up on the counter. It was a blast. But yeah, Stardust.
Yeah, I remember taking my older boy there when he was little.
Great place to take kids.
Yeah.
Great place to take kids.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So when you got to chapter three of How to Be a Working Actor, were you getting any work?
No. a little bit here and there, a little bit of a couple of commercials,
mm-hmm.
which at the time were really great.
Sure.
Because residuals came in, and I remember I did a Stroh's beer commercial, and that paid me for like my rent and everything for 2 years.
Residuals are magic when they work.
Oh, yeah. I mean... Fantastic. A little bit, and then my late 20s, I remember I got two jobs in the same day, which was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. One was a regional theater production of The 5th of July, Lanford Wilson's The mm-hmm. 5th of July in Portland, Maine. And I also got offered a job on As the World Turns. Wow. One was for a lot of money and a three-year contract, and one was for 4 months to go to Portland, Maine. It was a tough call. I was.
I wouldn't know what to do.
I was really racked because I thought I don't want to be on a soap, and this is a great play, but I took the soap and there are no accidents, and I'm so glad that I did, because the truth is that, you know, you know, you do an hour show in a day.
Yeah.
You know, an average hour on television for 42 minutes takes you anywhere between like 7, 9, 10 days for a 1 hour drama. You know, you do one show one day. But I remember the first 2 or 3 months I was on that show, I thought the boom was picking up my heartbeat because I was so nervous being in front of a camera.
Yeah.
But by the time I left there, I was there, ended up being there for 2 years. I asked them after a year if I could leave. They were not happy. But 6 months later, they came back to me and they said, "You still want to go?" And I was like, "Yes, please." And so they wrote me out. I think I married my cousin and I left. Yeah, I think it was, I married Meg.
And who did you play? What kind of character did you play?
Josh, the misunderstood farmhand. And then I changed my name to, you know, it was Rod Landry, and then I changed it to Josh.
I don't know that. I saw, because if you look at the listing of it, yes, it has three different names.
Do you know who Larry Brigman is, right?
Yeah.
You know Larry?
Mm-hmm.
He's a wonderful actor, and Larry had been on the show for like 30 years, but he did plays and film, and I always looked up to him, and he was there so long that he could kind of, he would just push the envelope on what he would do. He would pass by me in scenes on there, unscripted, and go, "Hey, Rod," or "Is it Josh?"
So, I mean, but this is like sink or swim learning, but right?
Soaps are hard.
Oh, hard.
People do not understand that, like, every time I speak to someone who was on a soap, that is training. You have to learn fast, and talk about learning lines.
Oh no, that's a different ballgame. You don't really have the time because you get the episode the day before.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You don't really have the time to explore it as an actor.
Right,
right.
You have to have those
lines.
What
is the deep meaning behind that? I don't know, but it's in 20 minutes.
Listen, but you know the thing that helps you out in soaps is that pretty much you say the same thing for about 4 to 6 weeks, and then you say something new.
Right. Well,
so you're kind of in the ballgame. But, you know, the one great thing about the soap after 2 years is, you know, and I, to this day, I say this, you know, my calm place is being on a set and there could be 50, 100 people and put that camera 12 inches from my nose and it's my peaceful place.
Mm.
And it happened on that soap.
Wow.
It had to, you know, I had to get to the place every day, 4 days a week. And, you know, and I'm really grateful for that. You know, the camera was, you know, I didn't fear it.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big transition.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, did I read it right? I was going through your credits. You made a return appearance or two in later years?
Well, what would happen is anybody that left the show, you know, 6 months later, there's a wedding or a funeral.
So okay.
They bring you back for two or 3 days. Well, let me tell you, I left that show. And my income went like a dive bomber. So whenever over the next, I would say like probably 3 or 4 years after mm-hmm. that, if a big wedding or a funeral came up, you'd be on for 3 days. And that was so welcome.
That's so funny.
You know, my daughter got married. So I came back, you know, to give her away. And, you know, and then I got punched and, you know. It was just so, there you go.
Wow. Do you remember the first time you were on a soundstage for a movie?
Yes. Yes. I don't count it as my first film
mm-hmm.
Because it was really small and a little bit more than an extra.
Mm-hmm.
But it was for Quiz Show and I played this like stage manager.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't count it because I had a few lines and they didn't make it in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But then about a year or two after that, that was not, you know, it's funny, that really wasn't a soundstage. That was in some like theater set and on mm-hmm. the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
But the first time that I was on a soundstage outside of some guest appearances on some television shows, but for a film,
yeah,
was my first film, which was The Underneath, the Steven Soderbergh film.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in Austin, Texas. And the soundstage was a hangar at an airport.
That's right. They turned that whole airport into a series of stages, didn't they?
Well, at the time, they were in the process of making sound stages, but it was still an airport. Because I remember one of the first scenes I had to shoot, if not the first scene, they were like, the first AD was like, "All right, roll camera, hold a second, B because there were like F-16s that were doing some training things. It was part of an air base.
Mm-hmm.
Bergstrom, I think. Mm-hmm. We all, you know, glanced out the door and you see the F-16s going, well, that sound isn't going to work.
Right.
So we had to kind of wait till they did their training and then, yeah.
It's too funny. It's too funny.
And did you find that that getting in the door, so to speak, with that feature, did that lead to others? Did it give you new contacts or people that you sort of counted on or became part of your posse?
Yeah, it's a great question because when I did the Underneath, I was 36. So truthfully, you know, everybody that I knew in New York, you know, fellow actors, everyone had done a film before me.
Mm-hmm.
And 36 is a long time. I moved there when I was 21. And mm-hmm. I, not that I didn't want to do theater, but I really wanted to work in film.
Mm-hmm.
So 15 years later, did I really feel like I got my first true one. And I auditioned for that when I was out here working on Grace Under Fire.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was working on that out here, I ended up with this audition. And that was great. And I remember the feeling that because I had lived in New York and studied in New York, that I didn't really come to L.A. So when this shift happened with Grace Under Fire, the one thing that I knew at the time is the group of casting directors out here, they didn't really know me.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that. I liked that they didn't know me. I felt like... So now what I started doing is I'd go back to New York. If an audition came up, I would say to my agent, People's Express was the cheap airline at the time.
Mm-hmm,
I
mm-hmm.
would say to him, can I do the audition in LA? And he goes, do you want to? And I'm like, I do. If it was something I really liked.
Because you wanted to establish yourself here.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but I liked the fact of walking into a room where people didn't really know you.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. No preconceived ideas.
No, none. I mean, I remember when I auditioned for Contact.
Mm-hmm.
I played a couple of like tough guys in a couple of movies, The Underneath, Heat, mm-hmm. that character of Van Zandt. And then I wanted to kind of shift gears a little bit. So, you know, some rough guys came along and I didn't want to play them. And sometimes I was a little more picky and choosy than I could have been or should have been. But I waited a long time and then this script came along and my agent told me about it, Contact, where it was a character, an astrophysicist who was blind. And I said, he goes, but you can only read the script here in the office, in the casting office. And I said, fine. So I flew to LA, got a cheap flight, read the script there, put myself on tape, flew back to New York, and then they liked it. And then they flew me back.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked going in when nobody
leg room?
Knew me.
More leg room on the return flight?
No. No, like zero. on the return flight.
On
yes,
the return
yes.
flight. On
absolutely.
On their dime, yeah.
Yes. I love that.
So the door started to open a little bit more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. The door opened up and all of a sudden this thing that I'd been looking for had a dramatic shift and the world of film started to open up. And I think that's the last time that I did a play
mm-hmm.
was back then, because when it changed, it was so welcome that, I still lived in New York up until 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I started spending time here, you know, got a little mm-hmm. tiny little apartment here. And I just liked the fact that everything was going in this direction.
Yeah.
Now, an acting career seems to me is maybe 50% good choices or smart choices and 50% sheer luck. Do you think that's a roughly accurate ratio? And I'm not baiting you. If you disagree
yeah,
with
no,
me,
no,
that's
no.
fine.
I, you know, I have to tell you, I feel lucky just to do this in my life. But the commitment to doing it is not lucky at all. It's commitment.
Mm-hmm.
That's the old, what's that aphorism? The harder I work, the luckier I get.
I totally believe that there's mm-hmm. truth in that.
Mm-hmm.
Do I ever think that I had that one lucky sort of break? No. I mean, maybe it'll show up, but it hasn't. I mean, and that's not to say that I have any complaints about the journey along the way. I don't. I feel grateful for it all. But it was I feel like my life and career is a culmination of of all of the things together. I don't think you ever look back and go, oh, this one role really catapulted him. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much that really happens for guys that are more character and nature.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, maybe it was just the teacher. It was the teacher who said, this is something that you're really good at, and you having to take a performing arts course, and that changed your whole life.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful yeah. thing, because otherwise we may not know you and you could be solving crimes. Actually, maybe the crime world needs you. But it's incredible to look at our stories and figure out when you zigged, when you could have zagged or done the play. Like you're saying, you know, when you have something like a play, which when you act is such a, it's nourishing. People talk about it. It's so special. Or do you do this TV show, this soap opera? Well, there is no right choice, because either one is going to be good for you. But how do you pick? You know, it's a lot. It's a lot to go through, I think.
And yeah. Yeah. And, you know, ultimately, I don't know, the older I get, there are no accidents.
No.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all going to take the road that it's meant to be on.
Yeah. 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 Now, did you make a choice? You alluded to this, and I hope I didn't mishear or misread what you were saying. But you did fall into a niche for a while playing bad guys. And it sounds to me like you made a conscious effort not to at a certain juncture. Am I right?
Let's try something different.
You know, yes, that is absolutely right. I remember when I finished, I think it was Heat, which the character of the small supporting character of Van Zandt was not truly a bad guy henchman sort mm-hmm. of thing. But I remember finishing that and thinking, I want to do something in a whole other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, the next time I worked was 9-10 months later.
Wow.
Which for a young actor was, you know, that wasn't easy.
No.
You know, listen, if you have blue eyes and cheekbones, this business thinks you kill people. Let's be honest about that. You know, I would say I've probably done around 50 films now, maybe 14, 16 of them are like true, like bad guys. But I say bad guys I've turned down plenty of roles, and I don't wear this as a badge of honor, but I've certainly turned down more money than I've made mm-hmm. on a particular film I would read it and I would think, there's no redeeming quality whatsoever, and I don't know mm-hmm. how I would play this guy.
Yeah.
Because if I can't figure out what a character cares about, I don't know what to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I can't give him a reason behind it. Mm-hmm. I remember I did this film called Albino Alligator that with Gary Sinise and Matt Dillon, and this was a rough guy. And it was a cool part, and Faye Dunaway was in it. And that was a tough call, because I worked on that for a week to try to figure out what makes this guy real. And when I felt like I had something, then I was like, yes, is it still available? But so do I think that I've played a ton of bad guys? Not really. But I think, you know, sometimes if they're memorable, you know, people think that's you. I've certainly done as many comedies
sure.
in film than I have like bad guys. But nobody goes, hey, I remember you and Drowning Mona.
I was going to say, go and Drowning Mona.
Go and Drowning
go
Mona.
Go, two of my favorites.
Yeah.
Two of my favorites. Go is one of the most wonderfully strange movies with an incredible ensemble cast. And your character is particularly amusing. And then Drowning Mona, I may be one of six people who've seen it, but it's one of my favorites because it's Bette Midler off her rocker.
Completely.
And the plank, was it Jeopardy? Do you remember?
Wheel of Fortune.
Is it Wheel of Fortune? That's what it is. You're playing, it's a sex game. Oh, it's a whole thing. Melissa McCarthy's in that movie.
I got a perm for that.
Oh, it's a solid.
How about, talk about an insane look. The director kept telling me, Nick Gomez, he goes, you know what? I want to play this guy like an Elvis thing. And he goes, can you grow some sideburns? I'm like, Nick, you should have told me a year ago.
Right.
But I started growing these like mutton chops. Oh, and then at the last minute, like 2 days before we started shooting, he goes, I want him to be like Bob Brady in the Brady Bunch. So I got a perm. And he goes, leave the sideburns. I'm like, do you really want me to live like this
apparently.
For the next 6 months, 6 weeks? So there I was with my mutton chops and perm.
Mm. Oh,
man. It is such a wonderfully strange movie.
Yeah.
and I enjoy it. And you got to be married to crazy, crazy Bette Midler, yeah. which is awesome.
Well, I'll still remember when the first day that we were working together and she walked on set, and Bette's not much older than me, but a little bit. And she walked on set and saw me and was like, ha, that's my husband? What, I robbed a cradle? I'm like, I didn't do the casting, darling.
That's a nice Bette compliment, though.
No, she was super great. Super fun. And that was the third time or the very first time, but then I ended up having two more experiences of working with Danny DeVito.
Yes.
Who I have to tell you, and I know you've heard this before, but he is one of the most wonderful people that I've ever met, not only in this business, just in life in general. Mm-hmm. What an unbelievable guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What a pleasure.
And so committed to what he does.
Ah, he's just
And he'll do anything.
Yeah.
I was reading an article about something crazy they had him do on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Just insane. He said, yeah, well, let me at it. I'll do it. He's a force of nature. He really is.
He called me about 10 years ago. My son was a freshman in college. I went to see him up in Maine, and I was driving back to my hometown of Buffalo to see my mom. And I'm driving along. I'm on the New York State Thruway, and my phone rings, and I don't recognize the number. I pick it up, and he's like, hey, Bill, it's Danny. I'm like, hey, how are you? He's like, oh, man, great, great. Listen, what are you doing? And I said, I'm just visiting my son. He goes, listen, I wrote this little movie, and we got to shoot it, and we don't have any money. I mean, like none. But I'm like, Danny, when are you doing it? You know, like in a couple of weeks, is at work or anything? And like 3 weeks from now, and I'm like, Danny, I'm in. I mean, it's Danny. I love him. I'm in. Then I got hired. Then I got offered another film, which is a pretty cool movie. Mm-hmm. And it shot at the same time. And it was a little bit of money and whatever. And I'm like, I can't. I'm sorry. I can't. Yeah. I got to do this thing with Danny. I still don't know whatever happened to it. It's called Saint Sebastian. I don't know.
My.
But it was Danny.
A film I just love. And I love almost everything he does. Rodrigo Garcia made a wonderful film called Nine Lives. And you have, it's vignettes.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Female-centric, as a lot of his movies are. And you have a segment with Amy Brenneman where you are deaf. Did you have to learn ASL for that film, or had you any experience with it before?
No. That was the first time that I had ever dealt with anything like that. And I'm trying to remember all the what I really remember of it is he shot the entire film in 18 days because there was one day to rehearse with a Steadicam and one day to shoot.
Wow.
And there's no editing in the film. Mm-hmm. It's a one take. So
yep.
if you
yep.
did it eight times, he'll watch it and pick the one. You might have a moment in the other one that was better, but it's no editing. It's one shot mm-hmm. deal. I remember working on the sign language. I remember being very concerned about what sort of vocality I would have.
Mm-hmm.
I was just trying to find all of that. And at the same time, you know, and then he's just deeply in love with this woman who is his ex, who's showing up at his current wife's funeral, you know, minor drama. But yeah, that was, I loved it. And I loved working with him and her.
Yeah.
And Mary Kate Place was in it.
Ah, oh, yeah. No,
that's all you need to know.
I know.
All you need to know.
I know. I was at the Berkshire Film Festival a few months ago with Cole Brook, and she was there. And
with her new film, Diane?
Yeah. And she was there. And I think it's the first time I saw her since we worked on Nine Lives. Mm-hmm. And the festival asked me somewhere during the weekend, when are you flying back on Sunday, you know, out of Boston? Can you take Mary to the airport? So so me and Kim Coates, my best buddy who I made Cole Brook with,
yeah.
I was like, you know, we went right up to her. We saw her at a party one night, and we were like, hey, we're your bodyguards on Sunday. So don't worry about anything, honey. We so took care of her.
I love that.
Delivered her right to the door of Delta Airlines.
Who would do otherwise, given the chance, right?
I know, exactly.
Now, you have this film, which is now available to be seen on video on demand.
Digital, all digital, multiple platforms.
And if you can't do that, Bill will come to your front lawn and set up a screen, like
yes,
a
yeah.
home movie screen.
He'll drive you to the airport.
I have.
Because this is truly a passion project, a labor of love that you wrote and directed and started, but you wrote it for yourself.
I co-wrote it to do with you know, and I'll back up a little bit. In 2001, I spent 5 months in Morocco shooting Black Hawk Down.
Mm-hmm.
The first day, you know, it was like I was over there 2 weeks. We were training, and our last Delta guy came in. It was this actor, Kim Coates, and I recognized him. I knew who he was, but he came on. He walked up. He's like, "Hey," and I was like, "Hey, man, join my group." And he's like, "Bill, Kim," he said, "where are you from?" I said, "Buffalo." He said, "Go Sabres, the hockey team." I was like, "Oh, this guy's my buddy. That's it. We're done." You know, 3 or 4 years after that, you know, I met my best friend. It's, you know, when I was 44, and he's such a great actor that I went to another friend of mine, Kane DeVore, and I said, "Listen, I got an idea for a story. We got to flush it out, but I want to write something that I do with Kim." I mean, that was always it from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that is how, you know, what kind of story would it be? You know, we kind of went in reverse a little bit. And what would be the story? And how do we tell a story about friendship and what happens to these guys? And how do they find their best selves? And I was committed to that kind of a story. And little by little, we put it together and found this thing. And where would it be? And where would it take place? And we'd shoot it in upstate New York, and, you know, where would the town be, and where would the cabin be, and all of these things. And, you know, it took years and years, and I got close to making it about 4 years ago, you know, but close in this business is zero. Mm-hmm. And then finally, a couple of years ago, I met some of these two Canadian producers through Kim, and they loved the script, and they said, "We'd like to be a part of it." And I said, "You can be as big a part as you want. Help me raise the money." And they did in about 4 or 5 months, privately, mm-hmm. which is so key, because ultimately I had like total creative control, and nobody was there to tell me, "You got to hire this person or hire that or do this." And you know, good friends of mine that are directors said to me, "You know, listen, this is never going to happen again, Bill. So it is better to jump off the cliff than be pushed. You know, do it your way." And that was the commitment.
And did you seek any other advice from filmmakers or directors you've worked with?
You know, 5 months working on a set with Ridley Scott, to be around one of life's most calm, generous, incredible people, you know, not that I at the time was thinking someday I'm going to direct, I'm going to watch this guy. You just absorb it, you know.
Sure.
Absorb the, you know, the guys along the way that, you know, to me, a great director shows you great trust. Mm-hmm. And because when you have trust, you feel like you can open up and you can mm-hmm. go. Great directors. I remember once I worked with the late Norman Renee, who made Longtime Companion
mm-hmm.
and was a huge Broadway director and arguably maybe the smartest director I've ever worked with. He just was so smart. He would just tell me one thing and it would just send me off. I wasn't even embarrassed saying to him, "Norma, can you just tell me how to say it?" you know, all of these things, you absorb it over time and then... you know, but I did Patrick Lussier, who directed this film called Drive Angry that I did a few years ago. He was the one person that I called before I left to go to Buffalo mm-hmm. on pre-production. I wanted to sit with Patrick because he was so wonderful to be around on set and just such a great spirit. I had a few questions for him. But ultimately, you know, it's not like I haven't been on sets and worked with actors and that.
And you're an actor. You observe. It's part of your toolkit.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you soaked up a lot.
Well, the biggest discovery was quite honestly, was day one. Day one, day two, day three. Because you'd think that this would be a really obvious thing that I'm about to say. But boy, did it come fast. And which was, you have to find the language for that actor because mm-hmm. everybody's got a different language.
Mm-hmm.
When Robin Weigert would ask me a question and it was 4 minutes long and detailed, you better have a 4 minute long detailed answer because that's what she hears.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Hanke, he's an emotional being. I found out with Brad make sure that camera is rolling and in focus during the final rehearsal, and and just let it roll, because his initial thing is unbelievable. And then he's like, woo, he's around the universe. And it takes you about 7 takes to get back.
Mm-hmm.
But all of them are great. It's just that first one, you know.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. I mean, and I enjoyed that. I thought, wow, this is, I like this. And of course, you know, I'm not self-directing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like I looked at the monitor and was like, you know, geez, Bill, you ought to really think about, you know, we've been working on it long enough. I kind of knew the story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd look at Kim Coates and I would say to him, how was that? You know, and he was like, you're really going to do it that way? And I'd be like, shut up. Get out of here. Go get me a coffee, would you?
How many days did you have to shoot?
20 shoot days.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. Shot the whole film in 20 days. It was creative scheduling. So it took, it took like 5 weeks to do the 20 days because mm-hmm. I absolutely refused to do a 6-day week.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted everybody to like live and,
Terribly humane of you.
Well, not yes. only that, but I remember I kept saying to my co-producers, they're like, we should begin on, I'll remember the date. We should begin on June 26th on a Monday. And I said, I think we should start on the Wednesday. And they're like, why? And I'm like, I just feel like that's the right thing. Because the 4th of July was the following week. So mm-hmm. we worked 3 days, off 2 days, work 1 day, off 1 day, work 4 days, off 2 days. I thought this was civilized, besides the fact that my son was going on this weekend camp thing over in Japan, and he was leaving on the 26th, and I'm like, I'm going to Boston and saying goodbye to him, even though it's in the middle of pre-production.
Yeah.
So I hopped on a flight and came back the next day, and I'm like, we could start tomorrow.
But priorities like that, I mean, that too is very important. I always said my dad made... I think did a really good job of always being at everything. Now, my mother had to go to all the choir performances and all the nights of shows. He got to do it once. You know, he saw the choir once. That was plenty. But it means a lot to your kids when you show up for those things.
Well, my younger one now, he's a football player. He's a baseball player. College is next year.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm so grateful for I did 2 series in my life, and each one was when each boy was in high school. Prison Break was one, and now Mom throughout his high school years. And if there's ever time, listen, doing a series is the closest thing to a regular job you're ever going to have.
Right, right, right.
Sure.
So it really gives you some stability. And at Warner Brothers right here, and he goes to school in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't let anybody go on the final run through on Fridays before the live show. You know, they like everybody to be there. They'll pamper you. They don't want anybody to leave the stage. They just look at me and they're like, they give me to, you know, go.
Yeah.
Because I will catch 2/3 of that game and run back before the live show. So I'm grateful for that.
That's really special, too. No, being an actor is being a gypsy vagabond person who goes all over the place. But when you have a family, that's what's interesting to me, is that a series is one of the best things a family person can do, because it puts them in the same place for a given amount of time. And that's rare for you guys. Normally it is that, like, well, it's 2 weeks here and then maybe a month or 2 or 3 there. Like you're saying, Morocco, places like that. Well, when you're a parent and a husband.
I know.
You don't want to be gone that long.
I took a job 8 years ago in Prague. It was 5 months, and I liked it, but I said to my wife, Kimmy, listen, I'm not going solo. I'm just not at that point in my life anymore. If we go, my son, who's 17 now, was 10 at the time, I said, I'll take this job, but we all go.
Mm.
And there's the International School of Prague is there, and if we all go, we go. And Kimmy's like, let's do it.
Mm.
Well, we fell in love with Prague, and she met sisters, not friends, and the job ended, and then it continued on a little bit. But we ended up staying 3 years.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we lived in Old Town Prague.
Wow.
And it's not like I'm like world travel. I'm a homebody. I mean, I'm never out and about town. I'm just not. I'd rather catch the baseball game for my son. But this was different. The job finished, and it was time to go back. And she didn't want to go, and I didn't want to go, and he didn't want to go.
Hmm.
And we're like, well, you know, if we can swing it, why don't we just not go? And so he went to 5th, 6th, and 7th grade in Prague.
Wow.
What an adventure,
just amazing. Amazing.
And then what made you come back?
Because it was time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just time. The end of his seventh grade, it was time to come back. Mm-hmm. And listen, the guy who drove me over there, Andre, he's like, just think Shrek. And Gabina, who was the production coordinator, Gabina and her two cousins have been to our house now 3 years in a row. They come for about 3 weeks and then they just like, it's their way station and they keep out. Mm-hmm. We're just friends for life. Andre came with his daughter and his wife last year. They want to travel about. I'm like, come on, drop your bags.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
What film was that for?
It was for a European television show called Crossing Lines.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Donald Sutherland?
Donald Sutherland mm-hmm. was in it. Mm-hmm. And it had a moment there where it almost worked. Kind of did a little bit in the beginning.
You try.
I try.
You do the best. But look what you got out of it.
Oh, couldn't back it up for anything.
That's wild.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was just incredible.
So you've been on the film festival circuit now with
Colebrook.
With Colebrook, we went to our first, you know, it's interesting because the festivals where Colebrook got into are kind of like the movie, Woodstock Film Festival, Napa Film Festival. So we didn't go to many. And even some of the bigger festivals that we didn't get in, I certainly got a lovely personal letter and, you know, back about, you know, thank you and maybe another time. But I loved the journey that we took with it, mm-hmm. especially Woodstock in the beginning, our very first one. Mm-hmm. You know, we all rented a house, me, Kim Coates, Kane, who wrote it, and, you know, a bunch of guys our age renting a house. It was like freshman dorm for adults. After 3 days, I'm like, I got to get out of here. I can't do this.
The
I can't
smell alone.
I can't sing Kumbaya at 4 a.m. This has got to stop. But it was great because, especially at the Woodstock Festival, this first time really in front of a public audience and I not that I didn't believe that the film worked, but I knew it that night, and that was pretty remarkable.
Oh, that's got to be a great, great feeling of satisfaction.
Oh, I was just like, I was so happy, so happy. But that was, you know, that was a year of post-production, and, mm-hmm. you know, you think climbing the mountain is pre-production and shooting the film, then when you finish it, oh, there's another mountain range after that. So it was a tough journey. Can't wait to do it again.
That's my next question. Yes, did it whet your appetite for more?
We finished Colebrook. I was back here. My editor was spending some time with the film. I gave him a couple of weeks to do a rough assembly. And in that time period, I got together with another great friend of mine, a gentleman named Michael O'Rourke, who's an incredible writer. And I'd known Michael for a long time, and I sat down with him, and I told him in detail for a couple of weeks a story that is a little autobiographical and based on a true story, a coming-of-age story in the summer of 1967. And Michael was busy with his own life in that. He gave me a script about a year and a half later. I gave him large overall notes, and then he gave me a second draft last week, and it's really good. I think it's really good. And I think there's still work to do, but, you know, knock on wood, that is the next thing that that I do. If somebody came to me and said, I have an incredible part in a film, I mean, incredible, or you can make this movie, I'll make the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've gotten bitten by the bug.
Mm-hmm. At this age? What's up with that?
No. Age has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, no, true. Yeah.
No, I mean, you have the passion, you have the drive, and now you have some experience besides, behind the camera and in the editing room and all of that.
The experience is just massive. I mean, I earned a PhD in about 2 years in a month. Mm-hmm. And it's not like like the journey's easier the next time. You just have more experience. You mm-hmm. have to reclimb the mountain.
Yeah.
You have to do everything again.
Sure.
Raise the money and everything. But there are people that I worked with this go-around that, I mean, I feel so blessed that so many things just fell into place. I remember my producers, when right before we started shooting the film, Colebrook, they were like, you need to tell us who your editor is. And I'm like, I'm getting there. And I called my agency up and I was like, listen, do you guys represent any editors? And they're like, well, yeah, a few of them, you know? And I said, well, could send me some names in that. And the one guy that could call me first, Like, he called me up and I talked to him. He read it and I talked to him for an hour. I was in Buffalo and he was out here in LA and he was so mild mannered and he loved the movie and he got these moments. And then he was telling me things that even I didn't think about. And I was like, and then we were all meeting together at some like baseball game or something. I'm like, listen, his name is Kieran Pellegata. I said, Kieran, this is great. I'm so glad we had a chance to talk. Can you come? Are you on? Are you in? Because I got to go. And he was like, are you asking me? Are you hiring me? I'm like, absolutely. Do you want to see my reel or anything? No. I love what you're telling me. And I could tell you this, the next time I go down this road, he is the number one person that I'm calling.
And it's got to be somebody you can get along with.
Yeah.
I mean, not just editorial experience or skills, the skill set that you have to call upon, but you're going to spend a lot of time together in a dark room.
Yeah.
And you better enjoy each other's company and have a real rapport.
Oh, absolutely. He's I learned a massive lesson with him in the beginning. I mean, listen, I don't really like to watch myself. I don't watch the mom show that I do. I've done a couple of indie films in the last few years that I haven't seen. I'm fine with that. I love the experience of doing it. I don't really need to like, oh, I got to watch myself. So, you know, it's just not my thing. But I did find in the first few days of editing Cole Brook that I was probably going to cut myself out of the movie because I would look at other people's things and go, oh, I love that. Get that moment. And one day we assembled this scene, the opening scene of the film. And I was like, let's try this. And I really liked that moment there. And he put it all together. And I'm like, it doesn't work. I like my moments, but it doesn't work here. I know what I'm doing. I'm cutting myself out of the movie. And this is what a lesson to learn in day one or two of editing the film. And I said, listen, you know what we're going to do from now on? We're going to talk about the scenes we're going to work on the next day. You come in before me by an hour. I'll come in and then let me see what you do. And then let's go from there. Man, that was really, you know, smart and wise and a little bit of wisdom on that one. But I also know that the next thing I direct, I will not be in.
I'd like to
take a different journey next time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you'll have proven yourself. You have already. You've got a real movie that's playing and people are watching. And you've been at film festivals across the country. You're there. You've done it.
Well, you know, like I'm here comes my Buffalo sensibilities out of me, you know, never putting the cart before the horse. And there is a massive sense of completion to get to this, like last Friday when the film actually was released on video on demand and digital and in 11 theaters around the U.S. There was that moment. The only thing that I had to do after Friday, really probably the last thing that I want to do for Cole Brook is coming here to see you today. Because when they gave me a list, this is true, when they gave me a list of potential things like a month ago that we might do for like PR, and I saw this show on there, I was like, can you please work that out? Because I'm a fan and I wanted to come here today. So I even changed the flight to go up to Napa for the festival today.
That's the highest compliment you
can. No, I did. I said, no, we have to do it. And they said, how about 11 o'clock Thursday? And I'm like, great, I'll get a later flight. So so glad that I'm here.
And now we're taking you to the airport.
Well, I've got it. Now I got to run home
and
see lovely Kimmy, which I probably, yeah.
Yes. We're going to let
get
you
out.
Go. We're going to let you go. And thank you. Thanks for the lovely compliment. And thanks for being here. And thanks for all the good work you've done and continue to do.
We are big fans, and we're so excited to have you today. We really are. And you're such a talented actor, and it's exciting to see this other side of you as well. You know?
Cool. Thanks so much.
I know you can do it.
Thank you. Are you a social media person?
I am such a dinosaur. The PR firm that's working with us said, let's have your social media. I'm like, I don't have any, you know?
That's right. Jesse makes up for
Kim,
that, though.
Kim Coates does. That's what I say.
Kim Coates. Okay. Go, Kim Coates.
He's got his 400,000 followers.
Amazing.
And where do people find us, honey?
You are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
And we're on Patreon as well.
Be part of the Maltreon family.
Yes. If you like what we're doing, help us continue doing it. Go to patreon.com/MaltonOnMovies.
That's right.
That's patreon.com/MaltonOnMovies. It's called Selling It.
That's it.
Bill, thanks again and continued success to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, folks. Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.